Welcome to a very special edition of the Portland WrestleCast. My name is Jim Valley. No music, no nothing today, because we are not talking about Portland wrestling per se, but we are talking about Northwest wrestling. Joining me now is historian and former wrestler Matt Farmer, and we're here to talk about the loss of an icon, really, in the Northwest for professional wrestling, for music, for the Cauliflower Alley Club. TV stations are even talking about it, the passing of Dean Silverstone. And before we get going into Dean's incredible life and legacy, I do want to make this clear, because it's the Portland WrestleCast, that when Dean promoted, he and Don were not working together. Right, Matt?
That's correct. You know, and in fact, Don Owens' partner, Dutch Savage, they were pretty much rivals during the time when Dean was promoting Washington State.
But that said, Dean, when he first started out, he worked for Harry Elliott. So you were saying technically he was under Don's umbrella for a little while.
Yeah, definitely. When Dean first started out, he was a publicist, referee, ring announcer, spot show promoter for Harry Elliott. And Harry Elliott at the time, dating back to the 30s, had worked for Herb Owen. And then later on had been partners with Don Owen and used the Portland booking office to book talent out of for all the towns in Washington. So in a way, he did work for the NWA at one time. Dean also worked for Sandor Kovacs out of Vancouver. And at the time, Don was a minority partner in the Vancouver office. And as I've talked to Dean about this before, when I would talk to Dean about Don's presence in the Northwest from Seattle to Vancouver, I asked him how much influence Don had over those booking offices. And Dean said the best way to describe it was Don was a Don, a real, like a mob Don, in that what they had to get Don's permission to do certain things, to make certain moves. So that's, you know, so there was, Dean did work in some ways for Don.
But that was in the very beginning. One of the things,
yes.
I've got the book in my hand right now, Dean's book that he wrote with Scott Teal, I Ain't No Pig Farmer. And Dave Meltzer talks about it being a great book for a small territory promotion. And that's true. But for me, you know, Dean talks about in the book that once he saw wrestling, he never wanted to be a wrestler. He wanted to be a promoter. And for me, with this book, what really stands out, other than the Seattle history, is that it's really the only book I can think of from like a promoter standpoint, where Dean talks about gates, he talks about cuts, and he really kind of explains everything instead of a wrestler's perspective that so many books cover. This is really a promoter's book, and that's one of the things that I like about it. Dean always wanted to be a promoter.
Yeah, very much. And I definitely see that. You know, I spent a lot of time with Dean, especially when I was really young, and he would talk to me about driving to different towns. And as soon as he got his driver's license, he grabbed a map and would just travel to different towns and map out, you know, find buildings, map out a loop that you would drive, you know, part of the territory loop. And he was always fascinated by that, even as a teenager. And it was interesting, his take on things. And he always had that promoter's take on things, which was really interesting. And, you know, a lot like Jim Cornette, you know, he would be kind of compared to Jim Cornette in a lot of ways and how he got into the business. You know, he first started, his introduction to wrestling, besides being a fan, was producing the weekly program that you'd purchase at the door when you walked into the arena. And that was really his first step into the world of pro wrestling.
He wasn't a part of the NWA. His promotion, how long was Superstar Pro Wrestling around?
For only about 3 years. They ran full-time 6 days a week, twice on Wednesdays. So the way the promotion was set up is every Wednesday they would tape television at noon in Yakima, which is in the center of the state. and that TV would be bicycled to the different television stations in Washington State. And then they would do a house show that night in Yakima. And their biggest town was Spokane and Seattle. Those were usually their biggest houses along with Yakima. And then all the towns were weekly or biweekly or monthly, or some of them were spot shows.
That's one of the cool things about the book. And I even loaned this book to my father-in-law, who's old Seattle, but he doesn't know anything about wrestling, and he enjoyed it because Dean paints a lot of pictures of what Seattle used to be like back in the day, and that's one of the cool things about it if you're from the Northwest. But talk about the wrestlers that Dean used. Who were some of his bigger stars?
For the Superstars promotion, some of his bigger stars were Eddie Sullivan, Rip Tyler, some of the early stars of this promotion, Rip Tyler, Eddie Sullivan. Of course, the Hells Angels, which were Chris Colt, Ron Dupree. Tex McKenzie came in for a while and was a big star. Lumberjack Luke was one of his bigger stars as well. It's strange because when Dean first started the promotion, he didn't go the route of, say, what he did is he traveled down to Tennessee and Florida and picked a lot of guys out from that region, guys that had never really had a lot of exposure or who had really never been seen in the Northwest at the time. So the talent that he brought in was almost the complete opposite of guys that Don was using at the time. There were a few guys that jumped from Don's promotion over to Dean's promotion, guys like Ripper Collins, who just had a very successful run for Don Owens. He came through one night and just decided to jump territories. So he gave his notice one night and then appeared for Dean the next night, and Ripper ended up being one of his more successful champions. And so what happened is Dean's first foray into promoting was when he was still working for Harry Elliott. He found a few towns like Port Angeles, Washington, that were not being serviced by Harry's promotion. And so what Dean would do is he would start promoting in those towns and build the town up. And a few of the guys he used was Shag Thomas, a very, very young Lonnie Main. In fact, it was Lonnie Main's first bookings in the Northwest were through Dean. And he would ran these towns, and he actually built the towns up to a pretty successful, where they were drawing pretty successful houses. And then the bigger promotions like Harry found out about it, or Sandor found out about it, they came in and started running those promotions. They took the towns over pretty much. And so that's when Shag was working for Dean, would have been during that period of time. He didn't work for him when he broke away as Superstars promotion.
You know, I was going through the book before we got on the air, and I did see a part about Lonnie Main saying that because he was told that Don Owen later on probably would not appreciate him working for Superstar Wrestling, Dean billed Lonnie Main as the Kentucky Kid, Bronco Burns.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
That's a great name. We talked a little bit about Don being a Don. How would you compare, or how would you talk about the relationship? Did Don ever interfere? I mean, some of the famous stories like Harley Race chaining buildings shut to keep the WWF out, things like that, famous promotional wars like with the Poffos, people can go back and remember. Did it ever reach that level with Don and Dean?
To a point, but at the Dean's main opposition would have came from Dutch Savage, who was in charge of running the Washington end of the Portland office. And like I mentioned earlier, Yakima was one of Dean's biggest towns where they ran their TV. As soon as Dean started drawing some successful houses there, all of a sudden Yakima became a regular stop for Don Owens' promotion under Dutch Savage. And that's when they started booking money-losing shows at the J.M. Perry Institute in Yakima, which is like a 700-seat auditorium, and they would run there every Monday. And the office didn't make a lot of money off of the shows, and you would think that a town that small wouldn't be a regular spot to run. But it was something they did just to put pressure on on Dean's promotion, even though Dean was out drawing him in the city probably 2-1 or more.
Dutch had a bit of an ego, and I remember one time Dean told me, and I think it's in the book as well, Dutch told him one time later on, years later, that he was amazed how well Dean did considering his level of talent, all the people on the roster. He didn't see them as the same level as Don Owens' crew.
Yeah, there was always that it's funny because I've actually been around Dean and Dutch at the same time in the same room and had them seen them talking together, and they were always very friendly with each other and courteous. But you could always tell there was a little bit of rivalry between the two of them, and they would always make these little biting comments to each other about, you know, Dutch would always mention that, you know, they won in the end, and Dean would always make sure to get a dig in about how head-to-head they would always beat Dutch in Yakima and things like that. So it was interesting. But yes, the talent that they used, that Dean used, because he wasn't established and because he was an outlaw promotion, a lot of the talent that they did have to use were talent that was not featured on, you know, in major territories with the NWA, because that would have caused problems with them getting booked. Like I mentioned, it was Dean and his relationship through Bobby Shane that allowed him to fly down to Florida. I believe it was Mobile, Alabama. I'm sorry. It was the Mobile promotion. He flew down there, and that's where he really picked out the core pieces of his talent, like Eddie Sullivan and Rip Tyler and some of those guys, and brought them back to the Northwest to start his promotion. So it was not guys that were established in the Northwest, and most of the guys did not have a track record out here already. So that was really interesting.
Well, you talk about that. A lot of unknown talent when they first got here. He was an outlaw promotion. You know, he had some disadvantages. Considering that, how good of a promoter do you think Dean Silverstone was?
I think he was actually ahead of the curve. When he started out, he really didn't have an infrastructure put in place. And he went from one day having been an assistant to Harry Elliott, who was a tremendous promoter. But Dean went from not owning anything, not owning a ring or having a loop set up or pretty much anything, to overnight running 5 to 6 shows a week. And you think about that. I mean, as a lot of people that might be listening to this might be in the industry or might be promoters themselves or have been part of promoting a show, think about doing that 5 or 6 nights a week. I mean, in that era, you had to make face-to-face contacts with local newspapers, the buildings. You know, there was a lot of things to set up, and a lot of that was done by yourself over the phone or by visiting those places. So I believe he was a very successful promoter. He just didn't have the resources available that a larger promoter would have.
Did you ever talk to him about his promoting philosophies? Did he ever impart any knowledge on you?
Yeah, yes, very much so, all the time. He was a promoter. Like he was one of those guys that was a born promoter. Even with his record stores, he was constantly thinking of ways to get the name out there or promote. Or even with the Cauliflower Alley, you know, he's been one of the main proponents of pushing that name and building the memberships and things like that over the years. So he's been a promoter.
Dean would have wrestler reunions at his home on, is it Lake Sammamish?
Yes.
Yeah, at his home. And to talk about the reunions, he did those for years and had a who's who of Hall of Fame wrestlers there every year.
Yeah, those were awesome. The reunions were great. It was usually a summer in July or August, and it would be a 2 or 3 day reunion, and wrestlers from all around the country would come. I mean, I've seen guys like Luthes, Fabulous Moolah, Pat Patterson, Ivan Koloff, The Destroyer, Red Bastien, Pepper Martin, a ton of big name wrestlers, promoters, wrestlers' wives, just anybody that was involved in the industry would come to his house, and he had a really nice house on a lake, and it was beautiful. It was such an interesting time too, because it was an invite only reunion, and so you would see the wrestlers there, and they would really like let their hair down, and they would just tell war stories and lie and rib each other, and it was always so much fun. When I first went there, when I was first invited, I was really young, and it was something that Dean did just to, Dean was always one of those guys to me that would teach me history. And he was always he would always try to teach me lessons, but not tell me he was teaching me a lesson. And so he would put me into situations with like these big name wrestlers or wrestlers of the past where I could just learn from. And I remember I asked him one year about coming to his reunions, and he said that it was only for veterans. And then the next year he invited me, and here I was really young around all these old veterans, and I was like from a completely different era. But it was such an interesting time, you know, getting to sit there and talk to guys like Don Leo Jonathan and Dutch Savage, and, you know, even guys like Buddy Rose and Ed Wiskowski and stuff like that, and Ed Moretti. It was so much fun, and they would just rib each other the entire time.
There are some pictures online of some of the gatherings and the amount of talent, legendary talent, in one area. It's practically like a Hall of Fame wing to a museum. It's remarkable. The stars, legendary stars that came each and every year for all of those years. Which brings me back to the first point I wanted to make with promoting. Dean talks about in the book, there was a story, I think it was at one of these reunions, wrestlers were talking about, I forget who it was, some promoter who didn't give them their fair shake, a very common thing that wrestlers say. And Dean kind of inserted himself into the conversation and said, well, let's look at the numbers. And he kind of walked them through the numbers and said, yeah, actually, it's about right. Your take was about right.
Yeah, that was a pretty famous story that Dean used to always repeat. It was one of those stories that Dean, repeated often. What it was is there was a stadium show in Phoenix, Arizona, and Tito Montez was one of the guys, local guys, that was pushed hard. And I believe is Mike London's old promotion. I might be wrong, but and they had this huge house. I believe Rocky Marciano was there as the special guest referee that night. They drew 12,000 people or something like that to a stadium, and it was for a Cadillac tournament. And Tito Montez went over in the tournament, and I believe his payday was $600 or something like that. And he thought, you know, as a main event, that he got cheated on his pay, and always complained about it. And Dean was crunching the numbers and looking at the rent, and he'd always joke that, hey, it sounds fair to me, you know, because he thought of it as a promoter side, whereas a wrestler, they would only think about it as on the wrestler side. But you know, when you book a big stadium like that, your expenses triple, you know, and a lot of people don't think about that. And that was something that Dean always implored on me too, is that, you know, you have to look at the numbers before you realize what the paydays are, you know. And so your payday scales could change depending on your expenses.
Somewhere there are independent wrestling promoters who are really confused by that last statement, Matt.
Yeah, I'm sure there are. Yes.
That's one of the things I do like about the book, I Ain't No Pig Farmer, you can find it at Crowbar Press, is that it is from a promoter standpoint. When it comes to a promoter, he wasn't the biggest in the world, but was he respected?
Yeah, he was. He really was. Of course, there was that that Portland wrestling bias, where you know, some of the guys like Buddy Rose, I remember Buddy always used to talk about how he was friends with Dean, but there was a time where he didn't want to be seen talking to Dean, because even though Dean was out of the business at the time, it was still a rival to the office, right? And so, you know, he had his enemies, but he was also well respected by a lot of guys in the industry. You know, I know Pat Patterson was one of his close friends, and that dated back to Pat's run with Harry Elliott in the 1960s, which was one of his strongest periods. You know, prior to really making it as a huge star in the United States, was when he was out here in the Northwest, and their friendship endured that entire time. Same with like the Destroyer, Dick Beyer. Dick had a really remarkable run in the Northwest, and Dean was one of those guys as a teenager who was kind of like their handlers on the road in some ways, where he would drive him to towns at times, or Dean would be the referee at spot shows, and he really took a lot of time to spend with those guys, and guys like Shag Thomas as well. He was friendly with those guys, and so he was well respected, and for the most part, everybody that wrestled for him has said that he was a good payoff man for that time, you know, and for the talents that they were doing. So I do believe he was well respected, especially later on when he got involved in the Cauliflower Alley.
We'll get into that in just a second, but I do want to mention, when you talk about how respected he was and things like that, you know, for me, maybe you saw Don Owens' promotion, Portland Wrestling, up here, maybe his big time wrestling in Seattle. I lived between the two cities, so I saw that. I never saw superstar wrestling, but for a generation who's a little bit older than us, in Seattle, they grew up on superstar wrestling on Channel 11 with Lumberjack Luke and all those people that you mentioned.
Yeah, you know, they had a really strong TV, especially. It's interesting, when the internet was first, you know, becoming a big thing, there was a lot of wrestling message boards, and one of the message boards, Kayfabe Memories, used to have a Northwest section, and there were so many fans that used to post on that message board, and they would just talk about, in glowing terms, superstar wrestling. And a lot of those fans were people that lived like in Eastern Washington, for instance, or in Idaho, or in Northeastern Oregon. And they were fans because that television was so strong in that area. And they had so many fond memories of superstar wrestling. I unfortunately never got to see it myself. Like you said, we're both a little too, me especially, we're both a little too young to have seen the video.
You just look older. Exactly.
Yeah. Guys like Lumberjack Luke, you know, that I Ain't No Pig Farmer, that was based off of a promo that Lumberjack Luke, and I swear it seems like everybody from that era remembers that promo, you know, that nearly got him kicked off of television. And so that was a really memorable time period for a lot of those fans.
Talk about what a typical loop was like for superstar wrestling back in the day.
Okay. We'll go Monday through Monday. So, I'll start off at Tuesday. Tuesday was Seattle. That was considered the home promotion. That was where the wrestlers picked up their weekly checks every Tuesday at the Eagles Auditorium, or the Masonic Temple, I'm sorry, in Seattle. Wednesday was, like I mentioned earlier, Wednesday at noon was a television taping in Yakima. And then that evening at the Yakima Armory was a spot show, or it was their house show, usually one of their bigger house shows of the week. The next day was considered what they call a spot show day. So it was either like someplace in Eastern, it was usually in Eastern Washington, like Wenatchee or Walla Walla or the Tri-Cities, like Richmond or Pasco. Fridays often were Spokane. and that would rotate from time to time, like Spokane or Moses Lake or something like that, or even like Lewiston, Idaho. Saturday was also a spot show, more often than not in Eastern Washington. Then on Monday, they would come back to Sunday. They usually had off. That was the only day of the week they'd have off, unless they booked Pendleton, Oregon, or a place in Idaho, or they booked a, in Washington at the time, you weren't able to run on Sundays unless you ran on, sovereign land, which is like an Indian reservation, which they did at times. But Monday was often Tacoma, sometimes Puyallup, Olympia, someplace in Western Washington. And then they would hit Tuesday, Seattle again, and they'd go all go back on the circuit again. During that time, they ran nearly every single city or town in Washington state, a few towns in Idaho, northeastern Oregon, like Pendleton. And they also ran some interesting places like Monroe at the correctional facility, which is a jail. You're familiar with that place, but they ran there a couple times, I believe, which, you know, would have to be an interesting story in itself.
Well, Monroe is now a women's facility, and that's where Mary Kay Letourneau was locked up. So it's kind of famous.
That's right. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
By the way, just to put things in perspective, you know, Spokane back then, it's probably anywhere, depending on circumstances, a 4-ish hour drive, anywhere up to 6. Probably same thing with Walla Walla. Lewiston, 5 to 7, again, depending on circumstances back then. So that's kind of what we're talking about with time frames. Middle of the state, Moses Lake, probably 3-ish hours, plus or minus, something like that. So just to give people an idea. What kind of crowds did Superstar Wrestling draw, size-wise?
Pretty strong. Their largest crowd was about 5,000 fans when they sold out the old Spokane Coliseum. When they were in Seattle, they never ran... they never stepped up and ran like the Seattle Center Arena, which is a 5,000-seat arena. I believe the biggest building they ran in Seattle would have been the Moore Theater, which I believe holds maybe 2,500 or 3,000 fans. But they usually stuck to the Masonic Temple, which would hold about 1,500 or so fans, maybe close to 2,000 fans. And they also ran the Show Box once or twice, which would hold maybe, you know, 800 or 900 fans. It was on the smaller side as far as an independent promotion, but they kept a small crew, you know, usually 12 wrestlers or less per night. And so, you know, 1,000 people would be a decent house. I've seen some of the checks and some of the weekly pay scales of wrestlers, and I posted them once in a while on my Twitter page, but wrestlers in that time frame, they were on a $300 a week guarantee, so that way they wouldn't make less than that, similar to like the WWE contracts today, except much smaller. So they were on a $300 a week guarantee, and then if the houses drew above that, they would get bumps above that. So a main eventer in Superstars, the checks that I've seen or the weekly pay stubs that I've seen, guys would probably make, you know, $700-$800 a week, which is not bad for 1974.
One of the big stars for Dean that drew him money, and it's kind of a bone of contention with he and Don, because he wasn't happy with the way Don used him, but Chris Colt was a big draw for Dean.
Yes, and Dean's talked about Chris often. Chris was a really, I don't know how to put it, maybe eccentric type of a character, really wild and crazy.
He's way out there even for wrestling. Even by wrestling standards, he's way above a lot of people.
Yeah, so much so, like a lot of the other wrestlers didn't even like to hang around him because he was so far out there. He was out there, you know, he was one of those guys in the 60s and 70s that was a heavy partier, really into the drugs before the drugs really got out of control in the wrestling industry, but he was really out of control. But when it came time to fill up the buildings, Dean has always put him over as his biggest draw. The Hell's Angels were really hot. Chris was one of those guys that was first, you know, one of the first guys to wear makeup in the ring, you know, on his face. And, yeah, he was just one of Dean's biggest stars. And, you know, they popped a lot of houses, you know. It wasn't uncommon for them to go to a high school gym somewhere and draw 1,500 people. You know, and you think about that, in a high school gym, your expenses are pretty low. That's a pretty good-sized crowd.
And did Don steal Chris Coltaway?
No. Chris didn't end up going to work for Don until after Dean was out of business. And if I remember the timelines right, Chris didn't go to work for Don until the late 70s, the first time, if I remember correctly.
But I do remember in his book, Dean talks about how he was frustrated because Chris Colt was kind of a lower mid-card guy for Don Owen. Briefly, he was at the top of the card, very briefly, but by and large, he was never promoted the way he was with Superstar Wrestling.
No, and I think that had more to do with Chris than with Don. Chris was just unreliable at the time, and I don't believe Chris worked for Chris didn't work for Don until after he worked for Dean. So, yeah, a lot of it had to do with Chris's personality. I've talked to some of his peers at that time that worked with him and tagged with him and stuff, and he was hard to work with, you know. And as talented as he was a pain in the neck. So, and Dean was one of those guys that really wanted to help Chris out a lot, but said that he didn't want to spend a lot of time with him outside of the ring because he was so crazy.
Yeah, Ed Moretti, who's probably on the normal side for pro wrestling, roomed with Chris a few times, and he has some great Chris Colt stories. But yeah, Chris is a wild man, even by wild man wrestling standards.
Yeah, yeah. Dean shares some great stories about Chris in his book, so yeah, definitely.
What brought about the end of Superstar Wrestling?
There was a few things, actually. There was an incident where their ring truck was in an accident. I believe they were crossing over the mountains during the winter, and their ring truck was in an accident. And I can't remember if somebody passed away in the accident. But it had something to do with their insurance rates going through the roof. And just, I think Dean, because Superstar Wrestling was pretty much a one-man job, he did have a lot of help from like J. Michael Kenyon and a few others, but he pretty much brunted everything was pretty much on Dean. He was on the road himself every night of the week. And I think it was between the insurance and just the wear and tear of the stress of everything is what ended it.
It's not an easy business.
You know, no. And in a situation like Dean was doing, he probably should have had a partner that was helping him every day, you know, because not only was he promoting and everything else, but he was on the road six nights a week. You know, minimum. So that had to have been a rough life.
Okay, let's do one more story before we move on. And this is from the book called Molotov Cocktail, the chapter of I Ain't No Pig Farmer. One of the prized possessions in my collection of memorabilia is a cassette tape recording a radio listener gave to me of a live radio performance that Lumberjack Luke and I did together on a Yakima radio station. While we were on the air, I extolled the virtues of the local people while Luke poked fun at their culture and revolved his comments around the topic of pig farmer, thus the title of the book. And while one of the callers was ranting on the air about Luke's statements, somebody drove to the radio station and hurled some type of an explosive device through the radio station lobby window. It created a magnificent explosion but did little damage other than the broken window. It did, however, knock us off the air. And of course, when the station returned to the air, they reported the details of what happened, and they removed Lumberjack Luke from their studio, and they vowed on the air never to have him on the air again or give, quote-unquote, that slob airtime. And he goes on to say, since the police department responded to the incident, the newspapers picked up on the event, and Luke was once again on the front page of the newspaper. A restaurant in Yakima called the Pig and Pancake began offering a breakfast special on their menu called the Pig Farmer Breakfast. I said we never went there because they were afraid someone might poison our food, but we were told the breakfast became a popular item and remained on the menu for many years. So somebody threw some sort of incendiary device through a window of a radio station just for calling fans pig farmers.
That's amazing. And Luke was one of those guys that loved heat, and that was something that, you know, well, he named his book after it, actually. But yeah, that was, I remember that was something that really popped a lot of the houses around that time, especially in Yakima and in Eastern Washington. And yeah, it just drove fans crazy. That's amazing. Just an amazing story.
Sorry, CM Punk fans. Lumberjack Luke had the original pipe bomb promo.
There you go, yes.
So, Dean, as you talked about, was an outlaw promotion, and sometimes the NWA, which had so much power back then, you know, you were looked down upon. You were on the outside. But somehow Dean was able to garner enough respect from people that, you know, he really was kind of the heart and soul of the Cauliflower Alley Club.
Yes, he was. You know, he worked tirelessly on that. I used to visit him often at his record store there in Wallingford, and it seemed like every 15 or 20 minutes he was getting a call, and a lot of those calls were not just about records, but a lot of those calls he was taking about the Cauliflower Alley, people that had just signed up or were getting ready to attend one of the conventions or something. And he was such a proponent of those conventions and reunions, and he loved going down to the Gulf Coast reunion as well. He had his own reunions here in Seattle, and it was just that friendship that he liked. And him and his wife, Ruth, they just loved being around the boys. And that's what it was about. You know, they liked that camaraderie, and he did have the respect from a lot of the wrestlers and bringing people together, which is a lot of fun, you know.
He was the treasurer, and a lot of people know that the accounts for Cauliflower Alley are set up in Issaquah, Washington, because that's where Dean lived. And Ruth, who passed away a few years ago, she handled a lot of the organization of the memorabilia room. And the Cauliflower Alley reunion after she passed was not very organized because she handled so much stuff, and it happened so close to her passing. But Dean took her loss very hard.
He really did. And, you know, they actually worked together on The Ear, which is the newsletter that's sent out to the members. And she had a lot of hand in actually putting that newsletter together. But yeah, he took that really hard. Since Dean passed away, a lot of his friends have commented that, you know, when she passed away, he really lost his, like, love to live. You know, they had a great life. I mean, they lived in an awesome house. Anybody that ever went to the reunions would always remark about how great his house was. And I mean, heck, it was right on the lake. And you know, that's that area, Dean, Jim, the real estate there is, you know, just, you know, I mean, heck, Bill Gates lives on the same lake, you know, so it's,
he got it years ago, and he's got a really nice house. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying, but he's been there so long that all of his neighborhood houses have been torn down for these recent, even bigger, extravagant mansions. And
yes,
his house is fantastic. Don't misunderstand me. It's like a classic car, though. It's just a different design from a different era. And you know, I was lucky enough. I didn't go to the reunions, and nor should I have. But he called me up one day and was like, hey, why don't you come out and see me? And I was like, my jaw just dropped. I was so happy. And it was a beautiful day. We sat out on his dock. We had a couple of drinks, and we talked about Cauliflower Alley. We talked about wrestling. We talked about Seattle. And It was one of the best times. I really, really loved it. I was so grateful that I got to spend at least that afternoon with Dean. And we would correspond, and because I do things with Cauliflower Alley, as probably people know, and I'd see him every year. So I wouldn't call us friends, but certainly we were acquaintances. And just a really nice guy. Really, really nice guy.
Yeah, really nice. And one of the things that always catched me is Dean was from that era of, and it always fascinated me that here he was working in the Cauliflower Alley today, in today's wrestling environment where everything's so open and so exposed and, openly talked about. When I first met Dean and I first started talking to him, I was a teenager and I was not in the business yet, but I was just kind of like breaking into the business, you know, like training and things like that. And he was very strict kayfabe. I mean, even years after I got into the business, he was very guarded and very secretive. And the stories that he would share with me were, you could tell that they were like his patented kayfabe stories, you know. And then as time went on, he slowly started like opening up and exposing different things. And by the end, you know, years later, he would talk freely and share these amazing stories with me. And we would really peek behind the curtain and talk about the real life things that actually happened. But when I talked to Dean about that, he said that was because his mentor, Harry Elliott, you know, broke in the late 20s and was extremely kayfabe, and they didn't talk about anything. And it was so guarded. Dean at that time, it was second nature for him to kayfabe. So it was really interesting to see him later on really like talk to people that weren't in the business or people that had not paid their dues or, you know, that and that's an old school term that he would use, because paying your dues at that time was such an important thing, in terms of the wrestling business. It was interesting to see how he would go on to just be such a big part of Cauliflower Alley when it was open to everybody.
One of the things that you do, Matt, is you're one of the driving forces, one of the key people with Defy Wrestling, a very successful promotion here in the Seattle area. Did you ever talk about Defy with Dean Silverstone?
I did. One of the last times I talked to him, actually, he came to one of our shows, and it was something it was in the last year that he went to one of our shows, and I talked to him a little bit about it. And Dean's health has declined quite a bit, and he wasn't driving so much into the city. Like we said, he lived out in Issaquah, which is about a 20-minute drive into the city.
Without traffic.
Depending on traffic.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He'd had some corrective work done on his eyes, and so driving at night wasn't that great, but he did come to one of our shows, and he was really impressed because it was a packed building, the crowd was hot, and it was really loud, and he didn't stay the entire show, but he did enjoy it. And it's interesting because all night long I was like, I wonder what Dean's thinking. So I called him up the next day and I was talking to him and I was like, so what'd you think of the show? He's like, I didn't really watch what was going on in the ring too much because he's not interested necessarily in modern wrestling. But he said, I watched the crowd, and the best compliment I could give you is that everybody was having fun. The place was packed. And as a promoter, that's what's most important. And I was like, okay, that's perfect, right? That's a great compliment. And so we did talk about promoting a lot. And I did talk to him a lot about Defy and my other promoting duties and things like that and booking. But he was always interested in what I was doing in the business. But he wasn't really necessarily always aware of all the characters and stuff in the business.
Yeah, obviously he was very sad about the loss of his wife in recent years. And also, you know, so many of the people who went to the reunions were gone. He hadn't had a reunion lately, right?
That's right, yeah. I think the last one he had was 5 or 6 years ago, maybe a little longer. But it was because of that. Yeah. So many people had passed away. I know a few of the deaths that really hit him hard recently were like Tito Montez and Lumberjack Luke, some of the guys that did wrestle for him. And those, you know, and J. Michael Kenyon, for instance, who, you know, is a legendary wrestling historian. Some of those deaths were really hard hit for him, and it just kind of like sapped a lot of his desire to put those things on, you know, and so unfortunately it was something that he no longer did.
He was sad, but he wasn't like bitter. You know, he didn't come and tell you, hey, they're doing too many flips or this or that. You know, if he had a problem with modern wrestling, I don't know that I ever heard it. He kept it to himself.
Yeah, we did have conversations about things that he didn't care for, but he always looked at it from a promoter's point of view. We even had discussions about that. As promoters, you just because you don't like something doesn't mean that you can't promote it, you know, because it is a business at the end of the day. There might be a wrestler that you personally don't care for, or maybe you don't personally care for what he does in the ring. But at the same time, if it makes sense and it's something that your crowd wants, your audience wants, then that's something you give them. You know, you got to take that ego out of it. And that's one of the things that he used to talk to me about a lot. There were wrestlers that he worked with throughout his years that he didn't care for. But at the same time, he knew he could do good business with them. And that was something that he pushed on a lot, you know, which is really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Dean was always really nice to me, and mm-hmm. we have some of his friends don't particularly care for me, and he apparently never let that cloud his judgment. So I mean, that kind of is a testament to who he was.
You know, a lot of people don't know this, but Dean was good friends with Ole Anderson, and that was something that he used to talk to Ole quite a bit, like on the phone. And that was something that I remember Dean talking to me about after a conversation that he had with Ole Anderson. For some reason they were talking about Ole booking Georgia Championship Wrestling in the early 80s. And they have a mutual friend that Ole had fired a few times. And it was a story that Dean related to me because it was, I think it was like directed as education about working with people that you don't care for and how common it is in wrestling. If somebody could do business and you could work well with them, just because you don't like them doesn't mean you can't do business with them. And that's something that Dean always like. That was one of the things that Dean taught me, I guess.
His other business was a record store called Golden Oldies. And if you're not familiar with Seattle, it's just off of the University of Washington campus on a very major street, just off the UW campus in a neighborhood called Wallingford. And it's also across the street from, I guess, the local equivalent of what would be an In-N-Out Burger, I guess, Dick's Drive-In. So a very iconic store. I mean, that's a big deal, too, being a part of Golden Oldies for so long. He only sold it a few years ago.
Yeah, you know, I think some of the, like you mentioned earlier, some of the local media picked up on the story of him passing away. And to a lot of the people locally, whether they knew that he was involved in wrestling or not, they knew that he was the owner of Golden Oldies. And at one time, he had 11 stores as part of when he franchised the store out, you know, 11 stores up and down the I-5 corridor. In Washington, from Bellingham to Olympia. And not only did he do business here in Washington, but his mail order business for his albums and 45s and things like that, it expanded globally. He had customers and clients globally. Some of his, I know in the Cairo piece that was written about him earlier, they mentioned a story about David Letterman, when his show was doing great business, they wanted to do a skit involving 100 records of somebody's album, and Dean had them for him. So, yeah, his record stores were pretty iconic locally.
Yeah, it does speak to his level of recognition in the Seattle area that, yeah, the local TV stations have stories on their website, and they did stories about him. And when you think about local television and how it's not really heritage anymore, people come to a state or a city and they stay for a year or two and move on to the next market, you don't have that intrinsic knowledge of pretty much any TV station, probably. So it's remarkable.
No, you
that
don't.
They still did. That in today's media where, you know, you blink and there's a new reporter on television or a new anchor, where'd that person come from? That they still did a story on Dean Silverstone.
Yeah, and Dean was always really friendly with the media, too. I remember we hosted a little, it wasn't a wrestling reunion. This was like a fan-invited like wrestling reunion about 15 years ago in Issaquah. And an article in the PI, the Seattle Post-Intelligence, appeared about this little reunion that we had, that I had hosted, that had maybe 30 people attend. And it's interesting because he just had a really great relationship with so many people in the local media.
There's also a story here from the KIRO website. It says, when Thriller was selling for over $1,200 online after Michael Jackson's death, Silverstone sold dozens of copies for $4.99, knowing that he'd get more repeat business by selling them for, you know, the actual sticker price.
Yeah, that's very interesting. For those people that have never been to his record store, it was an old building. But when you went inside, it had these just rows and rows of old albums. And an interesting fact about the rows, the album containers, is that when he ran Superstar Wrestling, they would have mobile bleachers that he would take from town to town and for buildings and places that didn't have bleachers. And when he closed Superstar Wrestling down, he actually turned these bleachers into storage units and tables for his record albums. And so the Golden Oldies that sits in Wallingford today, those album racks are old wrestling bleachers. So yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah, it's a one-of-a-kind experience to go in there. And he was there all the time, working weekends and everything, not that long ago, before he sold it. Maybe when he sold it, like, I think he sold it in 18. And maybe he kind of phased himself out a little bit before then. But he was there a lot for a very, very, very long time.
Yeah, even after he sold it, I know that he continued to go there and work and help out and kind of help with the transition for a good 6 months or so. Yeah.
But it's just remarkable. And I think it's a testament to Dean that you can be an outlaw promoter and reach the level of respect that he did in wrestling. You can run a record store in Seattle and reach the level of notoriety that he did in the Seattle area when, you know, Seattle is unrecognizable now from what it was during Dean's heyday in the 70s and before. And it's remarkable that he's remembered. And I think that's a testament to him and his legacy.
Very much, very much. Very, really interesting story. I would actually recommend anybody, if they can, jump on the crowbarpress.com and check out his book, because if you're a fan of wrestling or promoting or just interesting life stories, that's Dean's life, because he was a self-made man, you know. From the time he was a teenager getting into wrestling, he did it his way.
Yeah, riding his bike around, he knew what he wanted to do.
Yeah, very much, very much. He lived an amazing life, that's for sure.
Yeah, the book is I Ain't No Pig Farmer, Scott Teal, Crowbar Press, if you want to pick it up. Again, a promoter's perspective and a lot of great old Seattle and Washington history. So if you have a history buff, they might like it as well. At least that was kind of my impression from reading it. Matt, as we wrap up here, what would you say to when you think of Dean Silverstone and his legacy?
From a personal point, I think of him as like a mentor, because he was always there to give me tidbits of information and just share knowledge with me. And he also introduced me to a lot of people in wrestling. For wrestling, he was a conduit of friendship in wrestling because he took so much time and energy and put that into places like the Cauliflower Alley Club or his local Seattle wrestling reunions or even the Gulf Coast wrestling reunion. He really worked hard on bringing wrestlers together and forming that friendship and that ring of friendship that Cauliflower Alley promotes. That was really a testament to Dean. Dean really lived that model. He wanted to talk to people. He wanted to get to know them and really have that camaraderie among the wrestlers and the fans and everybody. That's Dean's legacy to me.
And if you want to honor Dean and his legacy, also go to CauliflowerAlleyClub.org. And if you're not a member, you should sign up. It's a nonprofit organization. Dean was the treasurer. And it helps wrestlers who are in the business who are down on their luck. And, you know, it's done a lot of good work. A lot of the wrestlers, you can't talk about what happened. They don't want it out in public. But the ones we can talk about, a few years ago, as you all know, Kamala has had amputations. And the Cauliflower Alley Club bought him a ramp, a motorized ramp to put on his van so he is able to be mobile. A few years ago, Frenchie Martin, when he was on his deathbed, he was worried about his funeral because his religious beliefs required him to be buried in a certain way. And Cauliflower Alley took care of that. So there's just things that they do. It's not very expensive at all. In the United States, for a new membership, it's $31 a year now. Also in Canada and Mexico, overseas, it's $49 a year. For a lifetime membership, in the United States, $312, and that's it. That's all you ever pay. Canada and Mexico, $467, and overseas, $570. And then you can come to the reunions that we do in Las Vegas every year. The new one has been moved from April to September. Again, go to Cauliflower Alley Club for more information. You would recommend people would sign up and be a member of the Cauliflower Alley, right, Matt?
I highly recommend it. Yes, it's a lot of fun.
Matt, you're the best. We're great friends, and I appreciate your time, your insight, and your knowledge. We all appreciate it. So thank you so much for your time and telling everybody about your friend and mentor, Dean Silverstone.
Thanks, Jim.